time to cancel the cabal. With Stephen Roberts. On peoplesinternetradio.com.
Okay, and welcome everyone to another Cancel the Cabal on People's Internet Radio, and I'm also on PSN Radio, and I'm on two of Shake and Wake radio stations, thanks to Annie Champagne and Angela Spino and Lorraine Gallagher. On four radio stations, as everyone knows, and I also YouTube podcast, and this is going to be for a YouTube podcast. We are halfway across the world from each other, me and my guests, so that's why we're podcasting this. I want to bring back, I've had Wal Thornhill on, Wallace Thornhill on the show two other times, at least two other times. I'm not sure if we did a third or not, but I know we have done two. Wallace Thornhill is part of the Thunderbolts Project, a group of scientists that are introducing alternative theories and alternative ideas. And well, we're going to start with a paper he just wrote on April 20th of 2020 this year. It's called The Electric Universe Hearsay, The Secular Heretic. I'm going to read a little bit of the introduction for the Electric Universe Hearsay. It says, in this groundbreaking paper, Wal Thornhill introduces a new theory of everything, the Electric Universe. Set aside everything you think you know about all these things, great and small, because the ideas presented here overturn it all. Was there a Big Bang? Not likely. Einstein's relativity doesn't hold up. In the Sun of Thermonuclear Fusion Reactor, I lost track here a little bit, sorry, which will eventually run out of fuel and burn out. No. There are black holes. Are there black holes? No. No such thing. What about dark matter and dark energy? Okay, I am segueing, going a little bit too fast. I am going as in one, but I should be taking these as in questions, because they are in questions. I'm going to go a little bit slower and read this out a little bit better. What about dark matter and dark energy? Forget about that nonsense and start learning about the science of the 21st century. The electric universe is the coherent cosmology that has correctly predicted and explained discoveries in the space age. For example, Thornhill specifically predicted an unexpected results of the Deep Impact mission to Comet Tempel 1 in October 2001. Almost 4 years before the event, he was alone in successfully predicting what would be seen beneath the clouds of Saturn's moon Titan. I want to welcome back Wallace Thornhill to the show. Thank you for coming on once again.
Thanks, Dave, and good morning.
Yes, good morning for you. Good evening for me. It's just a few minutes past 8 p.m. here in the Eastern. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, well, I guess maybe it's been about 3 years or so since I have had you on. Maybe you can go into a little bit more about what you have been doing for the Thunderbolts Project and what the team has been doing.
Yes. if it is 3 years, one of the events that upset us more than somewhat was that my friend David Talbot suffered a minor stroke, which has rendered him his mobility as a problem. As a consequence, I did two conferences in England, which was, I think, quite successful. And it was also nice to be able to come over to Europe and have a lot of European visitors and participants. The last one, which was held 2019, last year, was at Bath University. And there was a milestone reached at that meeting, because only days earlier we had confirmation that the Sapphire experiment, which I'll explain in a moment, had been corroborated, the findings of the experiment, which was the electric sun experiment, was confirmed by an independent laboratory. And that is extremely important because the model was put forward way back in the 1970s and by an engineer in America, Ralph Jurgens, also a colleague of Emanuel Velikovsky, who was the inspiration for my lifelong research into the electrical nature of the universe. if you look up those, the names of, or at least Emanuel Velikovsky's, you'll see there was a huge controversy in 1950, and effectively a modern-day book burning occurred at the hands of astronomer priests. So in other words, we haven't learnt anything for centuries. We still do the same old thing. We, the astronomers have their main job, I think they've seen it, is to corroborate their religious beliefs, not to actually look at the universe as it is. And there's a whole huge story behind that. But Ralph Jurgens did an amazing job. He published a paper, I think it was in 1972, in a journal in America. And in there, he said, when you look at the sun, there is not one feature on the sun that actually corroborates the thermonuclear model, the old idea that it's a nuclear bomb going off slowly in the sky. When you think about it, I mean, that's obvious. You just have, you would expect, and I've written this somewhere, that the sky would look like the 4th of July in that case because nuclear explosions are not controllable.
I've actually got a question about that. Well, if yeah. I may, I've heard sure. I heard close to a year ago that the actual internal temperature of the sun is quite lower than what the outside surface is.
Oh, well, you won't have heard that from the mainstream.
No, I didn't.
But
no.
certainly from us, yes, because that's part of the model.
Okay.
The actual, that bright ball of light that we see in the sky, we're looking at the very top of the atmosphere of the sun undergoing a global electrical discharge. And it was Ralph Jurgens who put forward a good engineering model of that. As a consequence, back in 2012, I had a phone call from a Canadian engineer who, as a result of the GFC, his business had been scuttled, more or less, by people who couldn't pay him. It was a $100 million Canadian company doing advanced engineering for big companies. And he was one of his projects was to look at solar panels and how to make them work better. And he came across my work. And he called me from Canada and said, I'm interested in what you're doing. Is there anything I can do to help? And so I put him in touch with my US colleagues because in being in the same time zone, that made sense. And he then presented at our conference, I think it was in 2012, the idea of an experiment. And he said the amazing thing about the electrical model of the sun is that he could find no engineering disparities. In other words, there was nothing there that challenged his belief in how things work. And that's important, as it turned out, because funding was made available independently. We couldn't rely on anyone in normal life to fund such an outrageous experiment that the sun is a ball of electrical lightning. And so we did a test experiment in a small bell jar because there were certain phenomena that Ralph Jurgens pointed out was critical to his model. They were tested and we confirmed that we could produce them in the laboratory on Earth. And then several million dollars was put into building a large 4 foot by 8 foot steel vacuum chamber and with an enormous amount of instrumentation and most advanced instrumentation to measure everything that happened in that chamber. And the result was that we were able to reproduce the things we see on the sun the energy of the sun and the fact that it is producing heavy elements in that electrical discharge in the photosphere. And that was the thing that was confirmed before the Bath conference. So that was a milestone. We had confirmation of the electrical model of the sun. Everything we think we know about stars is incorrect. Well, so that was the major thing, in those 3 years. At the same time, we've been putting out space news regularly. We try and get them out at least once a week. And we have had just a continual stream of confirmation of the electric universe and surprise and puzzlement on the part of the NASA scientists and that who are getting data from space and these amazing telescopes that are being built. The materials coming in is just supporting us. Now, we also have a Nobel Prize winner. We have several of them actually in the past history of the electric universe, which I'm very pleased to be able to point out, because I'm not a loner in this, and I've always realized that this is such a huge task that I had to share it with others. And we've had more and more scholars joining in over the last decade or several decades, and because this changes everything we think we know about the universe, it has huge ramifications, and it also has one of its most important things, in my opinion, is to let humanity understand our relationship to the universe. Because right now, the stories we hear from scientists about the universe and how it works and that there's multiverses and all this nonsense is just pure mathematical speculation. It has nothing to do with reality. Meanwhile, we've been benefiting from many of the experiments that they do. They've got the funding, we don't have it. And so we've just continually pointed out how all of this works simply, and that's the important thing. It's simple. You can teach this to, start teaching it in primary school, and people will just get it, because we have an intuitive sense, at least the engineers amongst us, of what will work and what won't. So this, in our present-day circumstance, is one of the most critical things I think we need to know, because we're going into that downward curve. I was born in the middle of the last war, and I've seen the sort of euphoria once the Great War is over, and people pull together, they work as a community, everyone is more or less feeling equal. And then you get to the point in the rising curve where those who manage to see that they can use the system to suit themselves do so more and more. And in fact, psychologically, the people who are most unfit to run countries and big businesses are often the ones who rise to the top eventually. And so then you have the downward spiral. And we're in that right now. Now, quite often that ends up in revolutions and war and all of this insane behavior. It really is insane. And Velikovsky himself, before he died, wrote a book called Mankind in Amnesia. And I consider that was perhaps, apart from the scientific work that he did, was one of his most important contributions. And he was an ideal person to write that book, because it was he was a psychoanalyst, and actually was the one who predicted that electroencephalograms would be indicative of brain disturbances and so on like that. So he was interested in the electrical nature of the brain as well.
Well,
his book, Mankind in Amnesia, said effectively that mankind is his own worst enemy, because he refuses to understand his past. All the creation myths and that are just there to be analysed and tell us in some detail what the heck happened to mankind. And there are, I remember reading or seeing a program by the last of the Celts, the Celtic people in Ireland. And they maintained their traditions, even though they sort of kowtowed to the church once it came along. And they had a group of three always who were trained in all of the ancient lore and ideas and so on, It fits perfectly with the Electric Universe. They knew there was a red planet in the sky very close. They knew that rocks fell from the sky to the extent that they had to build huge monolithic rock shelters and also live in caves. And then Caveman was a modern man. He wasn't the idiot that we tend to make him out to be. And all of this makes sense. And then, blow me down, here in Australia, the Australian Aboriginal stories of the dream time are some of the most accurate ones in the world. And that's the oldest extant group of or culture in the world, extending back tens of thousands of years. And all of this fitted with the work that my colleagues David Talbot, Duarte Cardona and Ev Cochrane have done into the study of what is the real history of the solar system. And that story would make one of the most phenomenal IMAX movies you would ever see. That's always been my dream that somehow, someday, that might happen.
Sure.
Anyway, this is, once you get me started, I could talk about almost any subject on the Electric Universe.
Absolutely. I figure, since you said it, the Thunderbolts project is about the only scientific thing that I do follow. Not that I have a great scientific background, a great knowledge of it or anything, but I do follow it. You mentioned just a minute ago about a red sun that might have been in our past. I've heard the theory out there that they believe at least one of our planets, Saturn and maybe one of the other gas planets, might have been suns in our past. Do you think there's any validity to that? Or?
Oh, it's a dead certainty. All of the evidence, including the descriptions of what happened in the breakup of that system, makes sense electrically. And this was more or less my main contribution to the Thunderbolts project. The word Thunderbolts came from the realization early on between David Talbot and I, when I joined up with him in 1994, is that the connection between my science and his reconstruction is the thunderbolt of the gods. What was that thunderbolt of the gods? And when you look at the descriptions of it, the artistic representations and so on, they don't match lightning. They have distinct shapes. And it wasn't until the year 2000 when we had a leading plasma physicist from Los Alamos Laboratories who worked on the Z-pinch machine, which is the most powerful electrical discharge mankind can make on Earth. It's like funneling all of the energy, more than all of the energy of all the power stations on Earth into something the size of a baked bean tin. And you observe it because of the energy, you observe it from about a kilometer away using X-ray telescopes. And blow me down, the discharge takes various patterns. It goes through various shapes. And when we got this fellow, Anthony Perrat, to come to one of our conferences, he was absolutely astonished. He said, I go hunting in the desert around Los Alamos and I see the rock art of the Indians. And he said, it never occurred to me that those strange stick figures and odd-looking things were actually representations of the things I've been seeing through this telescope when we produced these huge concentrated energy experiments. So the ancients witnessed it. So he actually predicted where you would be able to find those patterns carved in rock, and they're often in fairly inaccessible places. But he went looking, and it blew me down. It conformed with his view of how plasma behaves.
Does that?
I say plasma because lightning or fire or anything like that.
Right.
Is a plasma because some of the electrons are stripped off atoms and it becomes conductive.
Does that mean the Indians of thousands of years ago, seeing the electrical impulses are the plasma?
Oh, yes, there's no doubt about it. And what's more, they describe some of the devastation that it caused when these things struck the Earth.
Correct.
It turns out, actually, with the work of some of their people who've joined. Andrew Hall is an outstanding example. He was he worked in high energy shockwave phenomena and that kind of thing. So he knew that down to a T. When he saw what we were doing, he realized that those sort of energetic lightning discharges can blast holes. There's one just recently that was photographed in America where it blew about a 15-foot crater in the forecourt of a service station, a gas station. And there's also pictures of them, one in particular that Ralph Jurgens used back in the 1970s, was of a channel carved across a playing field in America, which had all of the features of the sinuous rills we see on the moon, which are not explained by flowing liquids. And this is one of the critical things, that the electrical energy of those discharges sculpt the surfaces of planets. And one of the major sculptures that have been seen in recent space history is that colossal gash that goes a third of the way around the planet Mars. And would you believe that the Indians remember Mars as Scarface?
Okay, sure.
They witnessed the scarring of Mars. Mars was close enough to the Earth. That in itself is enough to say that the solar system we see today is not a clockwork mechanism. It is roughly stable when there is no new body introduced into the solar system. When a large planetary-sized body comes in, all of the other planets have to adjust their orbits to suit. And in doing so, they exchange electrical discharges of colossal energy. And that's what the ancients were dealing with. That's what they witnessed. That's what they recorded. The Australian Aborigines was the giant rainbow serpent, which is a cometary reference. And of course, Velikovsky in his book in 1950, Worlds in Collision, more or less predicted that the temperature of Venus would be extremely hot, because he said within the memory of mankind, Venus was incandescent. And what did they find? I mean, they expected to find in the first probes to Venus, the Mariner probes, that it would be tropical underneath those thick clouds. Instead of that, the measuring instrument, it went off the scale. So they next time, Mariner 2, I think it was, it was designed to measure higher temperatures. And blow me down, it was the temperature at which some metals are molten.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if I've ever asked you in the past, but what do you and the team think about the holographic universe?
The holographic universe is partway to the truth. David Bohm, I think it was the scientist involved in that idea, and I appreciate what he did. He was one of these people who was prepared to think outside the box. But as somebody said, my work in the electric universe is not just outside the box, it's outside the warehouse. And that's the difference. The holographic universe is a way of looking at things which suggests that the whole is contained in the parts. And in effect, when you think about the universe as a conscious entity, we are a part of that consciousness. So the consciousness of the universe is represented in us. So in that sense, it's holographic.
Okay. I know I've heard... I'm trying to figure out how to say this. I believe I've heard the actual statistic that 99.999997% of an atom is free in open space, and science really doesn't know what holds the atom together.
Yes, that's true. quantum mechanics, strangely enough, and this is one of the major failings of 20th century science, when we decided that quantum theory and Einstein's theories were the bedrock of physics, we lost the plot, because neither of them have anything to do with physics. The quantum mechanics is a statistical formulation of the motion of electrons in an atom, you know, the orbital system. And Einstein's theory of relativity, what he's done is effectively made each observer lives in his own little universe. And the result of that is, by removing the absolute standards required by Newton's mechanics, absolute standards of length and time in particular, he destroyed physics. It means that you can change your clock speed, you can change your length of a ruler, and it will fit any finding you find if you mess around with it enough. Because, and in general relativity, that is just a geometric trick using forms of geometry of space which aren't real. So you can project it into three dimensions, into an extra dimension, or you can, and then mess around with it and then project it back again and end up with whatever you like. It has nothing to do with reality. So we keep hearing, you know, that Einstein was the greatest genius and so on, but even he had the intelligence to know that what he had done was unlikely to survive. It was the people who followed him who were really the main problem. Einstein's work would never have been accepted in modern day science because of, there was no peer review. He didn't reference his sources, and a lot of his stuff had already been discovered by others, but he doesn't refer to them at all in his papers.
I've actually heard from people that do have a scientific background. I don't remember their names now, but they've actually said to for the E equals M, the Einstein's theory of relativity to actually work, he had to leave out the ether.
Yes, that's right. And yet he accepted there was an ether, so he never explained exactly how he could get rid of Maxwell's ether, because basically Einstein's theory of relativity was designed to make some more sense of Maxwell's equations. But he did so in a way that was, it was purely just mathematics, and it lost any connection with a physical model. Maxwell worked, as all the scientists did in the 19th century, with a physical model. And he realized that you needed this mysterious substance which was practically undetectable, but it needed to be there to transfer light through empty space. And of course, you do. You cannot send a wave through nothing. You can't wave nothing.
Nothing is nothing.
The obvious.
Right.
But the problem is that everyone's been bamboozled by the mathematicians. It's probably significant, I think, that Stephen Hawking said that natural philosophy is dead. Well, they killed it, the mathematicians. Physics, originally, at my university, above the main entrance to the physics department when I went there, was embossed in the lintel overhead, the School of Natural Philosophy. Didn't say physics. And yet, the natural philosophers more or less lost the plot a little, following Immanuel Kant and people like that. And also, in the 19th century, most of the top scientists and physicists in those days were excellent experimenters, so they were dealing with real things. And this is what physics is about. It's about real things and observations. Now it's all mathematical speculation.
I think I understand that. I do.
People who come to read our stuff, if they can just come to it with a beginner's mind, they write to me and say, for the first time, I've always been interested in astronomy, but for the first time, it makes sense.
Sure.
Well, that's the main operating principle is the simplicity of the ideas. The more simple it is, the more likely it's to be correct. And the coherence. In other words, it has to make sense when you read it.
Occam's razor.
That's right. Yes.
Occam's razor.
You read science articles now, they read like science fiction, and that's the reason for that is they are fiction.
Sure. Sure. If you see the simplest answer, it might be the correct answer. Yeah.
Yes. The problem we really have in education is that we educate experts. We educate people, and so what we do is we tell them, this is the textbook, the answers are in the back, and if you get something else, then you're wrong. And that's nonsense. What you should do in real education is to give people an idea and say, okay, this is what's believed at present. Here's the historical picture of what happened. Who were the people involved and why was the decision made? And then ask them to make their own decision. Or you can present them with two ideas. That's all you need, two ideas. And as the noted American philosopher said, you need two ideas, one to kill the other. Right now, they're taught single ideas. You know, Einstein's a genius, the theory of relativity is correct, blah, 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 blah. And you come out the other end and it's like you've been trained to look the wrong way down the telescope. You've got this very narrow view of science, and as a result, it's incoherent. And experts in one field mislead those in another. It's very sad, for instance, that biologists are misled by physicists, and so they don't understand the signaling system that keeps that is behind consciousness and the difference between life and death. You know, what is a living organism? What is it that keeps it? All of those trillions of chemical reactions that are going on in this creature working in unison to maintain the coherence of this animal. And physics hasn't got an answer right now.
Okay. I don't want to get you in any kind of trouble or anything, some people might think this is a tough question. Do you think mainstream science is being intellectually dishonest?
No, I think the education system is the source of the problem. It's just this idea that it's onwards and upwards and we don't have to pay attention to what happened in the past. All we need to do is look at the research of the last few years and you'll find the answers that way. And in fact, one of the main things that has supported me in the view that what I've done is okay. I don't claim to be know it all, of course I don't, is to find some of the great scientists in the 19th century actually almost got here before me. So we've wasted 150 years, roughly. Some of the great German experimental physicists like Gauss and Weber worked out, for instance, Wilhelm Weber came closest. He deduced the orbital structure of the atom 40 years before it was discovered. And he did that from first principles just by using the electric force and saying, let's generalize it and say we've got two particles moving relative to one another and they're of opposite charge and they're different masses. Brilliant, you know, simple. And he deduced the orbital structure of the atom 40 years before it was discovered. I think that was one of the most significant things that happened in that century. Unfortunately, it was written in German, and its significance wasn't fully understood. Even Clark Maxwell, who wrote the foundational work on electromagnetism, devoted the last chapter in his treatise on electricity and magnetism to that the work of Wilhelm Weber and some of the other German scientists. So, you know, the information was there. It was available, but it was lost. And it's only in the last few decades that scientists in Brazil, who I've you know, found to be extremely approachable and a very good educator, has worked in Germany in his early years and is having all of the German works of these people translated, particularly Wilhelm Weber, because he came up with what's called an electrodynamic law. Now, we're all taught in school the electrostatics law, you know, how two charges either repel or attract one another, and this is the force law. And you'll notice that it doesn't include the time, you know, it's instant. And this is incredibly important, because it's one of the answers to how do you maintain coherence in a living creature. The living creature, all of the body, communicates instantly. But quantum mechanics, which as I said is not real physics, is puzzled by this, and they call it spooky action at a distance. And you know, they haven't got a physical explanation at all. It's not surprising, because they have no physical model underneath quantum mechanics. And the double slit experiment is easily understood when you realize that both the observer, the experiment, everything in the universe is part of that experiment.
Okay, you just happened to mention about quantum mechanics wasn't, I think you said real science, didn't you? That's sort of what I was alluding to just a few minutes ago about science being, mainstream science being intellectually dishonest.
Well, yes, but I think it's, I think that what we're dealing with is really, as I mentioned earlier, and what Velikovsky had to put up with, is the astronomer priest. And they behave like a priesthood. They don't actually, they're not trained to see what it is they're missing. I mean, it's quite remarkable. And it wasn't until I came across the work of a scientist in England, Dr. Ian McGilchrist, who has achieved a fair amount of fame now for his work on the way the brain works. Now, this is something that should be taught in high school, so that kids can understand the differences between people and their perception, and also for scientists to have some humility about their capability to do science, because you really have to understand yourself before you can do science. And nobody does. I mean, how many science graduates have done psychology? Psychology tends to be off in the arts department. And would you believe, here in Australia, the government is actually going to charge the art students double what they are the science students, with this crazy idea that science, technology, engineering and mathematics, or STEM, is the way to go. No, we need more generalists, people who can see across the broader picture.
Well,
and
we
that's
need
what we had in the classical era, of course. Classical training was, you did Latin, you did ancient history, you did modern history, you did everything.
And then you picked what you liked best.
That's right, and you could see it within the big picture. Our specialists today are actually functionally blind to the things they have not been taught. So it's quite incredible. It's a bit like that Dr. Erwin Sachs, was it, who wrote the book The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. It's just that serious.
Uh-huh. Okay, I do you know of the, well, it's a psychological term in psychology. It's called cognitive dissonance.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's it, really, and that's the function.
We are training
people in schools
not to be able
to see. I mean, the Dr. Ian McGilchrist has a very good video. If you look him up on YouTube, his first name, by the way, is the Welsh way of spelling Ian, I-A-I-N, McGilchrist. And it's very instructive, because he deals with this issue of education. And he said what we've developed in higher education is a hall of mirrors, so that you know, all you see is reflections of what you what you think, and not reality. And everyone is in that same hall of mirrors once you've trained in the same universities. In fact, there's, when you think about it, it's very difficult to get training to see things in any different way. You know, they all follow the same basic ideas. They all worship the same heroes.
Yeah, they all they all fit in the same box, if you will.
That's right. I mean, if they get through that, you know, disciplining, when they come out the other end, they're pretty much useless for anything else.
I have found in the 11 years that I've been doing this, Wal, that people that see themselves in a authoritative, insightful way, they don't really like to be questioned. They don't want to be questioned. They don't want their paradigm to be blown apart.
That's right. Yes. I had very early I learned that. Because I read Velikovsky's book when I was in high school, when I was just a lad. And at first, my first feeling was, this is amazing, but how can all my teachers have been so wrong?
Right, correct.
So I read it again before I went to university. I thought, you know, well, this will be great. I'll get to university and I'll ask questions there. No. If I ask those questions, generally there is some puzzlement or
did
they would
you
answer
get
the question
looks?
That they could answer.
Did you get scornful looks?
Well, they turned on their heels sometimes and were hostile. And I thought, well, that's a waste of time. But I managed to survive university and was actually beginning postgraduate research when I decided halfway through that I needed to get out of there because my heretical views didn't have any place to go. And so I joined IBM and went into the computing industry because I enjoyed the dealing with logic.
Well, I've got a short little story I can share with you. It was in 2007. I had rheumatoid arthritis, so I developed crystallizations on the end of my bones and knuckles. On the end of my ulnar bone, I developed crystallizations, and it tore the main tendon in my hand. I went to a general surgeon in a town about 30 miles away, a bigger city, and he did the surgery, and he put me in a cast, and he said, okay, come back in 2 weeks, and I'll take the cast off. I was not aware of any sort of thing different. So I did. I went to him. He took the cast off after 2 weeks. And I was in the middle of therapy. After about the third or fourth therapy thing, the tendon tore again. So I went back to him. And two or three people said, why don't you ask him to get a second opinion? Why don't you get a second opinion? So I happened to mention that to him. I said, is that going to bother you if I get a second opinion? And you would have thought I would have killed his dog. He was so taken back. It took him about a full 10 seconds to say, sure. Well, I did get that second opinion, and I went to an even larger town about an hour and a half away, and I went to he was a limb specialist, arms, hands, just basically arms and hands. That's all he did. And he said, yeah, you weren't in that cast long enough. It never healed. He said, if I would have done that surgery, I would have had you in the cast for 6 weeks. He did the surgery, and I had a cast on for 6 weeks. So, yeah, this other doctor was just blown away. Somebody questioned him.
Yeah. I think one of the things that is significant from my work is that it provides a foundation for examining the natural therapies scientifically. Because at present, with physics in such a miserable state, they are treated as outsiders because it doesn't follow their idea of the rules. And yet, once you understand this connectedness of all things in the universe, you realize that the natural therapists are actually, they've tapped into that, even though they haven't been able to explain it. And so putting the tests that university-trained medical people would use on natural therapies isn't going to work, because you're not doing the same thing, you're not doing the same science. So I think that's very significant. And once again, it comes down to a more general training would be a great benefit to everyone, whatever you're doing.
Sure. I'm actually going to watch these videos. I've seen two of them so far in this article here, the Electric Universe Hearsay. What did you what did you actually mean at the end there when you put the post title, The Secular Heretic?
Oh,
what did you mean by that?
I was contacted by The Secular Heretic and asked to write an introductory article for their journal, which they were starting up in Canada. And
so that is a publication?
Sorry?
The Secular Heretic is a publication?
Yes, okay. Yes. Okay. It's a web publication, so you can look them up and you'll see they've got a number of papers on philosophical issues and so on. And because I am a heretic, of course, I agreed. And so I made it, I put a lot of work into that. It's about a 6,000-word essay. And so I tried to place it in the latest context. One of the things that I picked up on and I thought was very important is we need to have this view of where we sit in the universe. And of course, one of the things I introduce is the response of one of the astronauts on Apollo 11, I think it was, Anders was his name, and he took the photo which became the famous one called Earthrise, where you see the moon rising, the Earth rising over the horizon of the moon, this blue, gorgeous ball flecked with white clouds. And that, he said, changed his whole attitude to the universe, religion, everything. And that effectively is what the Electric Universe is trying to do, is to give that perspective, looking at a much broader view of us and our place in the universe. And when you do that, because one of the things that Anders said was that it changed his view of religion and of humanity and what was really important on Earth. And that was to treat ourselves as a part of the Earth. And here we are destroying the Earth, destroying each other, and saying, oh, it's all right, you know, we'll just send rockets to Mars and we'll colonize Mars. Anyway, I mean, you can send people to Mars, but they'll become Martians.
Yes.
We are Earthlings, and we are all in this together. We are all connected. Our religions are a memory of a time when we thought we faced doomsday. And that doomsday fear has never left us. And people who suffer amnesia from an event like that tend to try and subconsciously revisit it. It's too horrible for the conscious mind, but the subconscious remembers. And in trying to remember it, we sometimes reenact it. So we go to movies, horror movies, ones where the world is to end. And we don't realize that what we're doing is trying somehow to deal with this memory that won't go away. Okay. The only way to deal with it, as Velikovsky said, was to actually understand it. He said, we must release the bonds of the past if we are to have a future on this planet. And I heartily agree.
Certainly. That was one thing you just mentioned, Jason, and I just lost that thought, too. I was going to go to it. Oh, well, maybe I'll have to ask it next time. But I know I will remember it. It just won't be in time for this particular interview here. But, I know what it was. What do you think about the historical mythology of War of the Worlds, or War of the Planetary Celestial Beings, if you will. And this will probably be the last question. We've almost got an hour here, so.
Yes. I love the story War of the Worlds, but I think what we don't realize is that we were involved in a War of the Worlds, and we were victims. And so a lot of these stories of War of the Worlds, we are the victims, but somehow we have to overcome it. And we invoke our gods or whatever, not realizing that the gods we invoked were the very things that caused the problem in the first place, the planetary gods. The question, okay. That raises the immediate question, why on earth were the planets recognized as gods when they're just these tiny points of light that most people can't even pick out in the sky?
Sure.
And yet they talked about them in great detail, and they all had very distinct characteristics. Venus was the goddess. She was female. She had long flowing hair, cometary hair. Mars was the god of war. He had this sword, which he used, and also Jupiter with the thunderbolt. There's a lot of confusion about Mars and Jupiter, but Mars was the one that was closest to Earth. It was the closest planet. David Talbot once was asked, how much of the sky did it fill? And he said, as closest it was 40 times the size of the moon. Now, you think of the oppressive feeling of...
That's very close.
Oh, yes, I think that could be be frightening enough in itself.
Wouldn't that have been close enough to have caused electrical discharges?
Yes. Yes, that was the sword.
Yeah,
the sword is the thing that descended from heaven. All of these ancient motifs: the world tree, the navel of the world, the world mountain, and the gods living on the top of a mountain. All of that is explained by the work of David Talbot in considerable detail. And when we look at the environment of the Earth and the memories of the earliest times, the purple dawn of creation, all of that is explained by having us, a satellite of our former sun, which we call Proto-Saturn. All of the ancient peoples recognize Saturn as a former sun. In fact, the words we use for sun today, or the old ones, Helios and Sol, originally referred to Saturn and were transferred to our present sun when Saturn disappeared. The ancient god departed.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think the ancients said that we had two suns in our site.
That's right. The Australian Aborigines, they've got stories, kids' stories, when there are two suns in the sky, a greater sun and a lesser one. And one of the lesser one, I think, hid in the hollow log. The hollow log was the plasma column, one of these plasma discharge phenomena. It's all there. And also this rainbow serpent, which descended to the earth, sculpted the rivers and the mountains and so on. So... where would they get these stories from? No,
sure.
There was a myth-making epoch which was not followed by anything like it afterwards. So it was a series of events which traumatized mankind around 10,000 years or so ago. And there were obviously things that happened in the following years which triggered the memories. And so the stories in the Bible, the Exodus and so on, triggered memories, I think, of those events.
Well, I've never been one to discount any piece of information whatsoever. I believe that there has to be, I wouldn't say has to be, but I would say that there's a possibility that ancient mythologies like the ancient Egypts, the ancient Egyptians showed their gods twice as tall, if not three times as tall, as the normal man. There are giants in the biblical sense, giants in the Bibles. There was the not just David and Goliath, but there was a tribe of giants that are talked about in the Bible.
Yes. part of the mythology refers to Mars. Mars at various times was a giant, and then I've reconstructed electrodynamically how that worked. It involves understanding gravity for the first time, which is, you know, gravity and magnetism are both the response of charged particle systems to the electric force. There is only one force in the universe, and that's the electric force. And everything, all the interactions of all matter is electrical. Once you've got that under your belt, it's simple, and it also explains everything. And Weber's electrodynamics explains the whole lot, including that fundamental discovery, or at least explanation for Mercury, the advance of its perihelion. That was the thing that drove Einstein's fame. That simple, that one observation that his figure matched, or roughly matched, that of the advance of the perihelion of Mercury, which was a big puzzle for astronomers. Weber's law does it. Weber's law introduces precession of the orbit of the orbiting particles. It explains magnetism. It provides a mathematical description of magnetism and gravity, the advance of the perihelions, and so on. All of this, and the equation is simple. You don't need advanced mathematics. You'll be able to teach it in high school easily.
Sure. I won't take up any more of your time. Do you want to tell us what you have coming up next, or what you have coming up in the future?
Yes, I'm working on the book I must write before I get hit by a bus, or, you know.
Before you get taken out?
I'm able to do this.
Before they put you in the pine box?
That's right, yeah. Before I join the great universal consciousness.
What do you want to share a little bit about that book, or just not this time? Or?
Not at this stage, except that it will be designed to fulfill what Professor Tommy Gold termed the science court. He said there should be a science court, because he said a lot of the proposals that are put forward these days in science wouldn't stand up to cross-examination. So the book I'm writing is designed to lay out the history, the people, all of the pioneers of the electrical model, and quite a few, and then put in the present state of science so that you can compare it with what is being proposed in the electric universe. And it should withstand cross-examination, which is something that can't be said for most of modern science.
Okay. Well, I do appreciate you coming on again and sharing a lot more information with us.
Thanks for the invitation. It was good fun.
Well, you're very welcome. And until next time, everyone, I hope you enjoy. Thank you.
Time to cancel the cabal. With Stephen Roberts. On peoplesinternetradio.com.